and Dr. Adams.
Three observations before we get started. First of all, Matt, or where you were born and raised, are you from the north or south? Or where?
From the north, Michigan.
Well, how come when you were talking to the class, you said y'all? You've only been here 2 years, so I don't understand.
I've been at UT for just 2.5, but...
Okay. Second observation is that we must have some Baptists in the room because you're sitting in the back row. Third observation is that I got my doctorate in marine science 30 years ago from UNC, and people say, excuse me, you marine science in East Tennessee? I just tell them I'm waiting for the tide to come in. You know, the last time the tide was in this area was 50 million years ago. So we're might now ready for another one, I guess. And I guess that's all the observations I have. I'll have various random thoughts through my talk. So, fourth observation is I haven't been quite working on this kind of stuff for 25 or 30 years. I've been in Oak Ridge National Laboratory for 30 years, but been working on environmental stressors and aquatic systems for about 15 years. So, as part of your amphibian ecology class, one of the modules is on your outline is talking about stress. I'm going to talk a little bit about amphibians because most of my work has been on fisheries, fish. Recently, we've got into more herp work with both frogs and tortoises, and I'll just share some of that. But the principles I'm going to talk about in terms of environmental stress and stressors, and we'll define those, can also be applied to most wildlife species. Whereas small mammals and birds, concepts and principles are the same. So I'm going to show you three examples of my work, brief examples. One of them I thought about doing was the Pigeon River. We actually worked on the Pigeon River in North Carolina, Tennessee for about 10 years, but all the data hadn't been analyzed. So I know that would probably have been of interest to you. So maybe next year when I come back, some of those people don't graduate, I'll come back and give that one. So, first I want to talk about concepts of environmental stressors and stress. Define what those are. Those are different, very different. And then some concepts about assessing effects of stressors, the idea about using multiple response endpoints. Because when we look at the effects of stressors on wildlife, herps or whatever, that is typically, we want to use a whole suite of things. Just like, for example, you go to the doctor and you're ill, you don't feel good. Doctor says, what's the matter with you? So, I don't really know. So that doctor will take a battery of tests. He'll take urine and analyze various things in that. He'll analyze blood chemistries, maybe take an EKG, lung x-rays and all that. And based on profile of different responses, he makes a diagnosis about your health. So that's, as you'll see as we go through this, that's one of the basic tenets that we follow. We look at a sort of a medical profile of wildlife species. And then I'll give three examples, brief examples. Well, maybe not so brief since this class is an hour and a half. Do you have a break in here anytime? It's up to me, right?
It's up to you.
Okay, it's about that time, right? Three examples, stream polluted by multiple contaminants. That's on the Oak Ridge Reservation, where historically, you know, the bomb factory and all the nice goody contaminants they released over the years. A coastal estuary experiencing eutrophication, and then, which may be more interest to you in this class because it deals with amphibians, ponds on an Air Force base that's affected by military activities. And then relevance and application. Why do we do this? What's the point? You know, that's what I call the so what question. Okay, let's look at some definitions of environmental stress and stressor. They're two different concepts. And people use, there's many definitions, but a stressor is any environmental condition, a situation, or environmental factor that causes a biological system. It can be a whole organism, it could be at the tissue level, it could be at the physiological level, to mobilize its resources and increase its energy expenditure. So then a stressor is anything in the environment or something even perceived in the environment that might cause a stress. So what is a stress? So a stress then is a state produced by an environmental stressor that extends the adaptive response, and I'll talk about adaptive responses of an organism, beyond its normal range. Or something that disturbs the normal functioning of an organism to the extent that the chances of its survival or productivity are decreased or reduced. So here's some, again, we're talking about just generally right now the framework or the concepts of environmental stress and stressors. Animals living in nature really say we can fall into four zones, four stress zones. They can be healthy, you know, really healthy. They can be stressed, which will represent this zone. Organisms can be damaged, but if the stressor is removed, they can recover. Or they may be incurring irreparable damage, in which case disease, reproduction, impairment, and death occurs. So this little blue line here sort of simulates the physiological condition of an organism over time if it's experiencing increased stress. So organisms may fall into this zone, that zone, and this zone. So I would say that most people in this room, not even knowing you, at least you're not fidgeting around or got any eye twitches or anything, are probably in one of these two zones. Let's hope you're not down here. You don't have any disease or you're not near death or anything like that. So we can apply that same concept to animals in nature. And that we can see the same principle on this figure here that, again, we have four zones typically that organisms in nature, fish, frogs, buffalo, whatever, elk, again, healthy in a stress zone, it's all in zone one, moderately damaged or severely damaged. Well, I think it's fair to say that most animals, most organisms in nature are probably live most of the time somewhere in this zone. In other words, they're stressed somewhat, but that's okay. To be stressed, as long as the homeostatic mechanisms of the body can compensate for that. In other words, physiologically and adaptively, all organisms, including us, have certain built-in compensatory reserves that we can deal with stress. But when those reserves are extended beyond the normal ability to compensate, that's when you start getting into pathologies developed. What is a pathology? A pathology is like a disease. It can be, immune system gets weakened and you're more vulnerable to disease. For example, everybody's heard of the cortisol. Cortisol is a stress response that comes from the adrenal gland. If you're stressed, cortisol builds up in your blood, causes your heart rate to go up, causes your metabolism to go up. And another thing cortisol does in the blood, it lowers your ability of your immune system to fight off stress. So let's say you're stressed all the time and you're around a lot of people all the time that cough and spread germs. You're much more likely to get sick or disease because your system has been compromised. Okay, in the zone two, moderately damaged, that is that the ability to compensate from stress is no longer, you've exceeded those homeostatic mechanisms of the body to compensate for stress, and then some way tissues, or it can be damaged, but if the stress is removed, you can have repair. But if the stress increases and not removed, then severely damaged, disease, and then death. Here's a general principle. If the rate of damage to an organism exceeds the rate of repair, then pathologies or disease develops. If the rate of damage due to a stressor in an organism exceeds the ability of an organism to compensate or to repair, then you get pathologies developing, lesions developing, disease, sickness, and those kinds of things. Am I talking slow enough? Luckily, I'm from the South, so I tend to talk slower than this guy probably does, right? But the problem is when I go to a big meeting, they give you 17 minutes for a presentation. And they recommend one slide per minute. Of course, I always double that. So I have to talk like this all the time, you know, when I give a presentation, flip through the slides because I want to get all 35 slides in. But luckily, we got an hour and a half here, so I can talk slower. Okay, following up on some more general concepts of environmental stress. Well, organisms in nature, and I'm using a fish here, but it happens to be a striped bass, which is very common to our reservoir systems here. Organisms in nature, including frogs, salamanders, all kinds of wildlife, turkeys, are typically subjected in their environment to multiple stressors. Remember, stressors are environmental factors or situations that may elicit a stress response in an organism. And in any one time, it's probably unrealistic to assume that an organism may be subjected to all of these different stressors at one time, like varying physical chemical factors. What are some physical chemical factors? Like changes in salinity, changes in oxygen concentration of the water, or something like that. Changes in hydrodynamic regimes, perhaps a flow rate or flooding. Let's say amphibians typically inhabit wetland areas or swampy areas, and you have a drought. And because of the drought, the water shrinks, and then the organisms are concentrated together. That causes a competition for food and more stress and ability and a higher probability that it'll get diseased. Habitat availability is a really big one. Does an organism have its preferred habitat available? In terms of the right temperature, the right food resources, the right physical structure of the habitat. Eutrophication. You probably have not even talked about your Cumberland study yet, have you? Yeah.
That'll be in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Gray he'll be talking to you. He has a big studies up on the Cumberland Plateau where he looks at the effects of cattle on ponds and in terms of eutrophication. Anybody know what eutrophication, what that word means? What is eutrophication?
Nutrients.
Nutrients and in the environment. Any particular kinds of nutrients? What are the two big nutrients that causes eutrophication?
Nitrogen and phosphorus.
Nitrogen and phosphorus, exactly right. In fact, in the coastal zone of the United States, the biggest emerging problem, environmental problem, is eutrophication. Do you know over 30% of the population of the United States lives within like 100 miles of the coastal zone? That's a tremendous impact on our coastal resources. And, you know, our waterways, our estuaries, our coastal systems, all this nitrogen, phosphorus, from all kinds of activities end up in our coastal systems, causes algae blooms and all kinds of stuff. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. And varying temperature regimes, of course, can be a stressor. It can be too hot, too cold, and even the variation of temperature regimes. Food availability, of course, is a big one. Does an organism have enough food, the quantity, or the right kind of food, the quality. So the quality and quantity of food is a big deal to most organisms in terms of its ability to live successfully in its environment. And of course, contaminant exposure from all kinds of contaminants in the environment, everything from heavy metals, leachates, PCBs, dioxins, pesticides. So the organism might be, in any one time, exposed to several or numerous of these, and the response we typically see of an organism is an integrated response. In other words, we want to know what its growth is, and we want to know what its reproductive success is. Those are the two of the big so what questions in terms of effects of a stressors. Are environmental stressors affecting the ability of an organism to successfully grow and successfully reproduce? If so, you're going to have a healthy population. Okay, sort of moving on to sort of the last of these general concept slides about stress and stressors. Environmental stressors can act in two major ways in the environment. First, we can have the effect of direct stressors on organisms. And the first level a direct stressor can affect is at the biomolecular, biochemical level. Affect things at the cell level or below. Affect the ability of the cell to osmoregulate, affect the ability of the cell to metabolize, all those kinds of things. If the stress continues, and then we might see changes manifested at the next level of biological organization. Now we're moving up the levels of biological organization. We're going to go from biomolecular to biochemical, to the physiological, to the tissue, to the organ level, that kind of thing. So if the stress continues to organisms and nature, we get physiological and pathological signs. And so really direct effect of stressors are manifested as metabolic responses, some kind of metabolic response. For example, increase in metabolism, increase in respiration, higher energy utilization. It's burning fat, lipids faster. Okay, the second major pathway by which environmental stressors can affect organisms, in addition to direct, is indirect. Indirect through two subpathways. First, I've already mentioned the quality and quantity of food available. The difference between a Little Debbie's donut and perhaps a good salad or something like that, you know, in terms of the quality of food. The quantity, of course, is just the total amount of food available. The indirect pathway can affect the quality and quantity of food through bioenergetics. In other words, through the amount of energy available. Let me give an example of that. Certain types of contaminants in the environment, like streams, can affect the macrobenthos, the little invertebrates that live on the stream bottom, mayflies, caddisflies, stoneflies. Anybody heard those names before? Good. I like to hear people shaking their head. That's good. So these invertebrates living on the stream bed or the lake bed or whatever are typically very sensitive to contaminants. And they are sometimes the preferred food of many kind of fish, like trout. So if these contaminants are knocking out the quality and the quantity of food, that food is no longer available to that fish. So that's an indirect pathway because it affects another organism before it affects your target organism. Okay, the second subcategory of the way indirect can work is through behavior. Stressors can affect the behavior of an organism. For example, temperature. Temperature is too high. It might keep an organism away from its favorite feeding grounds or spawning grounds or where it lays its egg. Eggs. So we have the direct and indirect pathways that can affect organism and population level responses, which are manifested through metabolic subpaths like increases metabolism and respiration, through bioenergetic, affecting the amount of energy available to that organism, and changing some kind of behavior of that organism where it doesn't function properly. So we got all these different things impinging on the organism affecting its growth and reproduction. And we're interested in growth and reproduction because that is key to the population success. Because if you don't have proper growth and or reproduction in a species, then eventually that population is going to be at risk. How many of you heard about the worldwide problem with frogs and amphibians disappearing? How many different species have disappeared? You haven't got to the chytrid fungus stuff yet, have you? There's a particular species of fungus that grows on the skin of these organisms that affects their respiration. I think you'll have a whole, don't you have a guest lecture on that? So the health of the organism affects the health of the population. And then lastly, the end product, the community. How's the community doing? Okay, finally, you see an amphibian. Oh man, it's about time. I ain't got no parasiting, Jerry. Sorry, buddy. Say, I ain't got, that's a Southern thing, right? Along with y'all. How about Mike and I? Anybody ever heard that term, Mike and I? No? Boy, is it because it's the end of the day, Matt? These guys are, they hadn't figured me out yet. Maybe that's it. Okay. let's look at specifically how an amphibian such as a frog can be affected by environmental stressors. We can have chemical stressors, depending on an organism in terms of chemical exposure or even the water quality. Another set of stressors is the physical chemical stressors like DO, dissolved oxygen, changes in hydrologic regimes, and of course the big one, habitat modification in terms of the quality and quantity of the habitat. Now how does the organism respond? The first level response in terms of, hey, how am I going to handle this situation, guys, is through the biochemical physiological responses. Things like organ dysfunction might be impaired. Its immune function, ability of the immune system to resist disease, perhaps even genetic damage. That's the first line response. If the stressor or stressors continues, these are the stressors, if they continue in their magnitude and duration, and then we start maybe seeing changes at the organ and the individual level. See, again, we're going up level of organization. Changes in its condition, growth, even behavior. And then lastly, if the stress continues both in its intensity or duration and magnitude and its duration, then we might expect to see changes at the reproductive and population level. In terms of things like changes in the egg and quality, size, quality of the eggs, abundance, size distribution, all those kinds of things. So here's one of the major challenges that affects us as environmental scientists. In nature at any one time, as I mentioned before, there can be multiple sources of stress. It can be pollutants, they can be nutrients, there can be land development, sedimentation, or whatever. And here are the organisms we're interested in, all kinds of wildlife. But the question is, what happens if we see a change in the organism, what caused those changes? Was it pollutants, for example, nutrients, land development, or a combination of all three? Because for environmental regulators and managers to effectively manage a resource, it's important to know the source of the stressor. Because if you got a bunch of frogs living out here somewhere and you think they're disappearing and they got disease and you don't know the reason for it, it's important to study that so you can actually identify the causal mechanisms. And I'm going to try to answer. You're going to see this slide near the end of my lecture that I'll try to show you how we can help identify the mechanisms that maybe cause changes in these organisms in nature. So the last slide before some examples sort of put all this together. I keep talking about this hierarchy of levels of biological organization in terms of effects of stressors, going to the lower levels, to the intermediate levels, to the higher levels of organization. Well, this is shown here, and this concept is that what we have here is levels of organization, biological organization, going from the molecular to the physiological up to the population community. And notice that in the upper left-hand quadrant, we have these lower levels of organization in general. And these are generally what we call sublethal stressors. They also, another characteristic of these sublethal stressors at the lower levels of organization, they have high sensitivity and specificity to environmental stressors. What do we mean by sensitivity? Sensitivity is they maybe respond rapidly to a change in the environment. In other words, there's a change in temperature, or there's a change in dissolved oxygen, or there's a change in the level of contaminants. Well, are there certain things we can measure in an organism that respond rapidly and sensitively to these things? Okay. The advantage of measuring responses in organisms at the lower levels of organization, like physiological changes, immunological changes, and they have high sensitivity and specificity to environmental stressors. But the limitation is, the downside is, they have low ecological relevance. That's the so what question. So what, we go out and take a blood sample from a frog, and we got measure all these things. We know it's lipid levels, we know it's glucose levels, we know all this stuff. But what does that mean to the survival of the organism? Does that mean its reproduction is going to be compromised? Does that mean its growth is going to be compromised? Well, we don't know. But if we take this approach by measuring a whole suite of responses in organisms and populations up to the community level, we come up with this. We have these things at the lower levels of organization, the higher levels, population, community, and they're ecologically relevant. That's what we call a so what. That's what we're ultimately interested in as environmental regulators and managers and environmental scientists. But the downside is they have low sensitivity and specificity. In other words, if a population of salamanders is exposed to low DO, not low enough to kill them, but they might be sublethally stressed. It might be generations or years before you see changes in population communities. So the major message here, and you'll hear this a couple more times throughout the talk, is that to realistically evaluate the effect of environmental stressors on wildlife, on organisms, we must include a representative suite of responses, from the lower levels of organization, because they're highly sensitive, quick responding, up to the higher levels of organization. So if we see changes in these kinds of things in an organism, And at the same time we're measuring these, we have a much higher probability of seeing that that environmental stressor, such as low dissolved oxygen, high temperature, disappearance of habitat, can be related to something we might observe at the population or community level. I know that's fairly complex, but I'll try to emphasize that in the couple examples I have coming up now. Everybody imperfectly clear? Jerry, are you clear about this, buddy? I can call on you since you're not taking this class.
So far, so good.
You got any questions?
What about that?
This guy's a parafighting guy. Anybody know what parafighting is? Who doesn't know what parafighting is? Please raise your hand. Parafighting is algae. Like it grows on rocks and things like that in a stream. It's a primary producer. So you don't have to have the guest lecturer come in and talk about parafighting. I got that one covered now. So anyway, this is an overhead view of the bomb factory at Oak Ridge. This is what the salt affectionately called the Y-12 plant. This is where they, up to few years ago, manufactured most of the warheads for the U.S. military. This is where the A-bomb was developed, the Manhattan Project, you know, the bomb they dropped on Hiroshima. The parts were manufactured here, the parts sent out west and put together. But anyway, it's a major, used to be, now the Cold War, you know, it's not, they don't do much warheads anymore, but for 35 or 40 years, it was a major manufacturer of warheads and munitions. And it produced all kinds of goodies. I mean, all kinds of contaminants and stuff. And these contaminants basically came out in a drainage ditch, came out along here, ran into a polishing pond, and then discharged into actually a natural stream here that runs through the city of Oak Ridge. Here's the lower parts of the stream. It looks fairly natural. But here's the situation we have. We have this the bomb factory here, the Y-12 plant. The city of Oak Ridge is here. But this yellow line is the contaminated stream running down this way. It empties into the Clinch Poplar Creek, which goes into the Clinch River, which ultimately goes into the Tennessee River. But what we did, starting in the late 80s, early 90s, we set up a series of sampling stations to look at a gradient of effects. Our hypothesis was that we have a gradient of environmental stressors, particular contaminants in this stream, originating from this facility. So what we'd expect to see is a gradient of effects. We have a gradient of stressors, so we'd expect to see a gradient of stress responses or effects. So here's our gradient of stressors. This is the stream flow is this way. This is the site one, is the site closest to the production facility. This is levels of mercury in the water. This is levels of PCBs in the fish. And this is levels of PCB in the sediment. Now everybody's heard of mercury probably, unless you live in a vacuum these days. You heard of mercury is a big environmental global concern. You know, mercury in tuna fish and pregnant women aren't supposed to eat it and all that kind of stuff. Well, back in the 40s and 50s and the 60s, as part of the weapons production program, they used tons and tons and literally tens of tons of elemental mercury in their production process, along with lithium. And back then, they didn't care about the environment. The war was on. They discharged all of this stuff into these creeks. It was washed down the creeks and went into our rivers. It went into Watts Bar Reservoir, some up in the Chickamauga Reservoir. But you know, mercury is a very, very potent neurotoxin. And most of the inventory of the mercury now, by the way, is buried deep in the sediments of the reservoir. It's no longer bioavailable. It's no longer our environmental, most of it is no longer an environmental or human health risk. But anyway, we do have a gradient of stressors in the system, mainly contaminants. Now, I want to see if there was a cause and effect. If we see a gradient of stressors, do we see a gradient of stress responses? Well, the first thing we wanted to look at is actually the macrobenthos, the invertebrates that live in the stream, that serve as, for example, food for upper-level consumers. Here's a guy taking a Cerber sample and putting a sample down and collecting all the bugs in the bottom. So here are the results. This is the most contaminated site. Going downstream is a reference site. This is a number of taxa per sample. In other words, this is the diversity in the sea. So what we have is the most polluted site where we have the most contaminants. The diversity of the community is depressed. You only have tolerant species. The sensitive species are out. All you have is the tolerant things left, like dipterans and carinomids, you know, of the, you know, the fly family, those guys that can survive low DO and all kinds of bad things. You don't have any clean water organisms there. And then we also took fish samples, electroshocking for fish, and we saw the same gradient. We saw a gradient of diversity in the fish community, the lowest diversity, the most polluted going downstream. Then we asked the question, okay, these are community level responses. What do we see in the individual fish? Well, this is our what we call a sentinel fish species, or what some people call a keystone species. A keystone or sentinel species is a species in a system that's either dominant in terms of its abundance, or is important in terms of the food chain, or energy flow. It's sort of a it's a really important in the system. In other words, you remove a sentinel or keystone species, and the system sort of goes wacky. But this is the this is a centrochid. This is a red-breast sunfish. It was our model organism we wanted to use to look at effects. This is a mature male and a gravid female. At the lower levels of organization, we knew some of these toxicants affected the gill structure. So this is an electron micrograph of a gill filament taken from a fish from a healthy system. And we see the nucleus, we see the nucleolus here, and then a mitochondria, very clear in the health. This has not been exposed, this gill has not been exposed to any contaminants. Anybody know what the mitochondria, purposes of mitochondria? Who said that? 2.5 extra points next exam. Good. All right. It's respiration, energy processing, and that kind of thing. The next slide is an electron micrograph from a gill filament from a fish taken in the upper part of this stream that's contaminated by mercury. Notice three things. The nucleolus is, and the nucleus has disappeared. The cisternae, those little laminated things inside the mitochondria, are basically trashed. And you got these dark staining bodies. These dark staining inclusion bodies are what we call a very specific biomarker of mercury intoxication or mercury effects. So we do, what this tells us is, yes, these fish were exposed, these organisms were exposed to mercury at the levels that cause damage. Remember that general framework slide I showed where I had the zones, where I had, you know, the first zone was everything's okay, I'm okay, you're okay. The second zone was, stress. The third zone was damaged but repairable. This is probably the fourth zone, damaged but irreparable. Now the question is, would damage like that to the gill, for example, affect the health and survival of the fish? Well, we looked at other things too. We looked at, you know, we talked about, I mentioned reproduction as such an important endpoint and looking at effects of stressors. This is steroid hormones. This is estradiol in green, and testosterone. These are the two main reproductive hormones in organisms, in all vertebrates. Very necessary in development of the eggs, proper development of eggs and so forth. So what we see here is again a gradient that these steroid hormones are depressed at the upper parts of the stream, and they have basically recovered to about two-thirds of the way down in the stream, but there's a sewage treatment plant that comes in right here. Sewage treatment plant from the city of Oak Ridge knocked it back down again. But there is some evidence that These stressors in the streams are affecting reproductive function. Another thing we looked at is genetic diversity in terms of how we know, for example, that mercury is a genotoxicant. Mercury can is not only a neurotoxicant affecting the nervous system and how one behaves, but it's also a genotoxicant. It can actually destroy or mess up DNA. So what we found here with these fish living in this stream was that this is the percent of the population with a resistant genotype. All this is, so this is saying, this decrease is saying that the mercury has selectively removed all the sensitive fish from the population. And the only thing is left is the more resistant individuals. And you can see in terms of the population genetic diversity that by the lower end of the stream, it sort of approaches that of the reference. So the last slide for this first example is, okay, you might say you measure a whole lot of things. Yeah, that's great. Some of them, three slides and stuff. But what does it all mean? Well, going back to the profiling concept, remember I talked about in medical, the medical doctor will measure a whole bunch of things to try to diagnose your health. Well, we do the same with wildlife. And this is a statistical procedure. We have Jerry. It's called canonical discriminant analysis. I'm sure you'll be using that in analyzing your data. That these ellipsoids that look like sort of footballs represent the integrated health response of fish at three different reference areas and four sites in the contaminated stream. In other words, for everything we measured, all the biochemical, the physiological, the pathological, the immune system stuff, we crunched those into one major analysis. And what this represents is the integrated health state. And if these footballs touch each other or overlap, that means there's no significant difference in the health of fish from this site to this site. So two important points here. Is that the three reference in green separate out well from that from the contaminated stream, which means there is a big difference in their quotes health. The second point is the generally the most contaminated site is the farthest away in distance from the reference sites, and they have a gradient downstream. This is the least impacted site in the polluted stream, and you can see that's sort of closer. But now, I want to go to a second example. This is an estuary in North Carolina that was impacted by high levels of nutrients. And in September 16th, 1999, Hurricane Floyd came ashore. Shoot. I haven't figured out this thing yet, man. Came ashore right here. Here's North Carolina, South Carolina line. To orient everybody in the building, here's Myrtle Beach. Now you know where you are. Okay, so here's Cape Hatteras, you know, Outer Banks, Norfolk. I came ashore right here, southern Onslow County. Winds wasn't very high. The winds were only like 100 miles an hour, but the thing stalled. It rained and rained and rained. It rained for 3 days. And preceding this, there was another small hurricane that had soaked the soil. So within a 10-day period, this eastern area of North Carolina got like 48 inches of rain or something like that. And all the rivers and everything were overwhelmed. This is the flooding from it. For example, here's the houses that were next to the Intercoastal Waterway. There's a fence here. The Intercoastal Waterway was over here in some channel. But the big thing is, in Eastern North Carolina has what they call mega hog farms. They got hundreds and hundreds of these mega hog farms where they might have 1,000 or 2,000 hogs. And you can see the effects of the flooding on this. First of all, the water's starting to come up. These are barns. And then the water keeps coming up. The hogs are trying to get away. You know, they get on top of the barn. And then the thing I want you to see here is these are the barns where they're kept. This is a sewage lagoon. These things have huge sewage lagoons. So the state requires that, you know, they keep all this stuff in here, and then it's degraded, you know, like a sewage treatment pond. And then all this stuff, all these sewage lagoons were breached because of the flooding, and it went into a large river, the Neuse River. So you can see the sewage plume for all these combined. There were hundreds of these things coming down the river towards the towards the ocean. So this is a Landsat photo, like 10 days after the hurricane. What we see here is this is Cape Hatteras, Cape Lookout, Myrtle Beach is right down here. Flooding, most of the flooding here, it came into the Neuse River, to the Pamlico River, and all these hog farms are up in here. So what you see here, this is a turbidity plume. All this stuff went out into the estuary. This is the Pamlico estuary. This is the second largest estuary in the United States behind Chesapeake Bay. And this turbidity plume went out the inlets and is advected into the Gulf Stream over 100 miles. So from space, you can see what the effects of this flooding was. What's this got to do with amphibians? I don't know. I'll tell you later. So what we did then, we did a study for the state of North Carolina. Since I did my master's and PhD research right around in this area right here, I knew this area pretty well. So these nutrients and turbidity came down this river. So we had a sample station for fish, not frogs, but fish. We have an affected site here in the Pamlico Sound and a reference area here that wasn't affected. So we got A and B, and let's look at the oxygen profiles of A. Okay, A is in the river. B is out into the sound where all this high turbidity plume, all this mess has been washed out. So A is the river, and you can see these are bottom DO profiles, dissolved oxygen. A significant part of the river has oxygen below 2. You move out farther out into the estuary, it gets up into the 2 to 4 to the 6 range. So what happens in eutrophication in this case then? We had all these, we mentioned that before in terms of environmental stressor. We got all these goodies coming in. We got these big time algae blooms, very productive. All this stuff eventually dies, settles to the bottom, has a biological oxygen demand. It's sucking up oxygen from the water. And our little critters that live down here, fish and starfish and everything, they take it in the shorts because there's not enough oxygen. So, yes?
What's the average oxygen demand for fish?
The average? DO. Depends on the species, like, you know, brook trout, high in the Smokies. I mean, they got to have it out there. But catfish and carp and those things, you know, they can live long time at 2 or 3 parts per million. Every species is different, but you know, a general rule of thumb is anywhere from probably 4 to 8 parts per million. That's a good question. So our hypothesis for this study is the fish sample from areas in this estuary with low dissolved oxygen are sublethally stressed compared to fish from a non-affected reference areas. We had 2 species of fish representing 2 different lifestyles. This is a flounder. It's an ambush kind of predator. It's basically eats shrimp and crabs, stuff off the bottom. And then the spot is more of an omnivorous, picking off little things off the bottom mainly. It just forages all the time, sort of like a carp, benthic forager. Chose 2 species because of the 2 different lifestyles. We because it was very difficult. We needed all these fish alive because a lot of the things we look at, like enzyme systems, we have to have organisms alive when we capture them. We can't put out a gill net or a frog trap and come back later and they're dead and we use them. So there were some commercial fishermen down there called pound netters. We paid them like something like $6 a pound to catch these flounders for us. And we brought them back alive into the lab. We had 30 fish from each of the two sites, 30 fish from our infected site with low dissolved oxygen, 30 fish from a reference site. We brought them into the Duke Marine Laboratory. And boy, I'm glad to see them having that bad basketball season. That just does me really good. Almost as bad as the Vols, right? Except for the Lady Vols looked really good last night. If it wasn't for Parker, they'd probably lost the game. Everybody agree with that? Everybody see the game, right? Everybody saw the game? We brought them back into the Duke Marine Lab and worked them up and did all these stress measurements on them. I'll just go through these fast because the specific results won't mean much to you. This is the hematology in terms of things like hematocrit. Hematocrit is the amount of blood cells. Hematocrit, red blood cells, this is an indicator of number of white cells. It's an indicator of infection. We won't do this one. Serum protein. This is our reference site and affected site for the two species. The main thing I want you to see is for the affected site with a low DO, we have elevated hematocrit. This makes sense because organisms that live in environments with low DO, how do they compensate for that? One thing is they increase their red blood cell count. I know you guys are too young for this, but back in the 76 Olympics, there was a guy from Finland called Lasse Virran who won both the 5 and the 10K in the Olympics. And he was accused, he came out of nowhere and won both the 5 and the 10K in the Olympics. He was accused of blood doping. They said they took his blood out and then enriched it with oxygen and increased the number of red blood cells and put it back in him, and then he won the race. They've never prove that. But anyway, a higher hematocrit, more red blood cells, give you higher affinity for oxygen. This leukocrit is a measure of white blood cells. White blood cells are typically indicator of disease. They fight infection. Leukocytes, you know, they're phagocytic, and what they do is it's like an amoeba, remember, they engulf foreign particles. So anytime we see an increase of this, could probably mean organism might have a disease. We looked at general condition indices in terms of things like lipid in the blood, how well it's feeding, how well the liver's doing. This is an indicator of liver health, an indicator of spleen health. Again, for this spot, spot was in bad shape compared to the flounder. The flounder's doing pretty good. And the reason is the flounder typically hangs out in shallow water. You know, it's only in a foot. So it's not going to encounter those deoxygenated hypoxic zones. Whereas the other species, the spot, is a benthic forager in deeper water. So it was making forays or incursions probably into areas where there were low DO. Okay. And the main important thing is the reproductive indicators. That's what we call the so what. All these other things are nice to know, but if the organism is not growing and reproducing successfully, then we got problems. Well, again, the spot's not looking very well in the affected site. The amount of testosterone is decreased compared to the reference. The estradiol in females is severely decreased, significantly decreased. And particularly the percent of fish with ovaries developed. Significantly lower. They just wouldn't develop in their ovaries. Okay, we got one of these multivariate things again. So just like that last example, I took all of these things we measured, which included 7 different immunological responses, 2 hematological, 4 physiological, 6 repro, and 5 condition. Had 24 different stress indicators that went into these integrated health responses. So two important points here I want you to see is that for both species, we're stressed because this is the affected site. They were separated in space. They didn't touch each other. They didn't overlap each other. So they were significantly different in their health. And so was flounder. Second point part is the spot are relatively more stressed than the flounder because this is a measure of the statistical distance between the class means. So this distance is larger. This means that the spot were more stressed, if you want to put it that way, relatively more stressed than the flounder. And this makes sense in terms of their lifestyle because the flounder is an ambush predator and hangs out in shallow water. It was shallow water is more well mixed. He probably didn't encounter any epoxic conditions. Okay, what y'all been waiting for, y'all came here for this. Finally, you're getting some in herps. Finally, which this guy's talked for an hour and he finally getting his help. So, tell you about a study we currently have going at a large Air Force base in Florida. Eglin Air Force Base is in the Panhandle of Florida. It's the largest Air Force base in the U.S., 500,000 acres. It's due east, close to Pensacola. But we're looking at primarily the gopher frog, also the leopard frog. They're the same genus, Rhino species. The gopher frog, and this is a map of its occurrence. The gopher frog is dark green, occurs up into the coastal plain of North Carolina all the way down to the coastal plain of Louisiana, of course, along the Gulf Coast and most of Florida. And the other species we're looking at a different military base at the same time as the gopher tortoise. I won't talk about that data. I mean, it's a herp, but it's not an amphibian. I mean, we're just analyzing the data now. They're called gophers because these tortoises actually dig burrows. And they have very powerful front claws, and they dig these burrows. It has to be the right kind of soil. It can't be all clay. It's too hard. If it's all sand, they dig the burrow, then it collapses on them. It has to be the right mixture of sand and clay. But these things they're very climatically controlled. I mean, they come out in the middle part of the day, sun themselves, feed a little bit, then go back in the hot part of the day. But gopher tortoises in many parts of the southeast can be almost considered a keystone species, again, because even though it's not that abundant, what it does, these burrows form niches or habitat for many other kinds of organisms. The frogs use them, diamondback rattlesnakes use them. I've actually seen some guys that stick their hands down in them things, not knowing what there's down there. I mean, that's like them grapplers guys on, you know, those catfish. Have you ever seen that on Heartland series, where those guys go in the reservoir at night and they barehanded, they stick their hands underneath these rock ledges and pull out these catfish and snapping turtles? You're grinning. You don't do that, do you?
No, I've seen it.
But you know what I'm talking about. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Of course, some of them they call nubby, you know. Some of those are nubby. You got. But these burrows are very important ecologically because they form habitats for many other species. But we're focusing on the gopher frog at this Air Force base, which is, boy, I can hardly see. It's right, this is Panhandle of Florida, but right in this area. Okay, this is the outline of the base, 500,000 acres. Here's Santa Rosa Sound. Pensacola's right over here. Panama City's way over here. Oh, yeah, this is Destin. So that's where, but this, of the 500,000 acres, like over 400,000 is wilderness, in buffer zone. And because of that, and because of the rich flora and fauna down in the coastal area here of Florida, this thing has like, it's like has 300 species of endangered or threatened species. So these military bases, in essence, form havens or refuges for wildlife because, Bubba can't get in here. Anybody know who Bubba is, right? That's what they call rednecks in and down in Florida and southern Mississippi. They can't get in there, so there's plenty of habitat for them. But what we wanted to do is ask the question. The question was, does military activities, which is the stressor in this case, have an effect on the gopher frog or the leopard frogs? Because we're afraid we won't get enough of them, so we have a surrogate species is the leopard frog. So we set up an experimental design where we have three different kinds of treatments. We have military areas with high disturbance in red, medium and low disturbance in reference areas. So we have, these are ranges, and these are, all three of these are either bombing ranges, different kinds of bombing, or heavy duty troop activities like small arms fire, tanks, all kinds of stuff. So we got those three major treatments. And what we did to assess the military impact, we took these various sites, which you saw in the previous slide, and we said for each site, we ranked the amount of contaminants at each site from 1 to 3. So if it has no contaminants, that site gets a 1. If it has low contaminants, a 2. High contaminants, 3. So for each site, we looked at how much contaminants was at a site, how much ordnance was per unit area, unexploded ordnance like bombs, cratering, here's a bomb crater, per unit area, how much soil disturbance, which relates to habitat disturbance, burning and scorching, and so we added all these together, in other words, a composite score. So these sites have all these particular stressors or impacts, so these particular sites had high activity, these three moderate, and these three low. So what we want to do is collect frogs from these particular treatment areas with high stressors, moderate stressors, and low stressors, and ask the question, what effects do these different stressors have on the health, integrated health of these organisms? And so our sampling design for the gopher frogs was we have three high disturbance areas with bombing ranges, three low disturbance areas. These are basically bombing ranges in historical, they're no longer used, but there's some contaminants, there's some habitat disturbance in three references. Here's a overhead photo, Landsat, no, it's not a Landsat, I'm not sure what kind of, overhead flight of a low disturbance area. This is ponds. And then we have a high disturbance area with some ponds, and then a reference. You can see the difference. See all this vegetation and trees? So you can really see the difference just from a large view of the fact you've got a lot of vegetation, a lot of good habitat here compared to this landscape that's really been, another word we use, boogered up. So for each pond, each of these ponds, we went out and did some surveys to characterize the situation. For each pond, we looked at this morphology in terms of, looked at its, you know, its length and width and depth, the water quality, general substrate, what kind of vegetation is in it, is it good? In other words, ask the question, what kind of habitat is it for frogs? Would a frog want to come there and breed? At each pond, we either had 2 or 3 transects. Along these transects, we looked at we did random plots. We looked at the kind of vegetation. We recorded the kind of vegetation there, whether it was low grass or shrubs or larger vegetation. We also looked at land cover, disturbance. It was any bomb craters, was there any contamination and those kinds of things. So each one of these ponds for all these treatment areas, we're looking at characterize the habitat. Because as you saw in one of those slides I showed originally, habitat quality is so critical to wildlife. In fact, one of my conclusions over the years looking at various species and various systems is that habitat in most cases is more important than things like maybe either water quality, food availability or contaminant exposure in affecting the organism, the quality of the habitat. Okay, what we did at each of these ponds, So we got each of these, each ponds. We got like 40 ponds we did over the whole military base. We set these drift fences. This is just the Nitex netting, and we got these live traps we put along this net, so that the deal is when frogs start to move to breed, they'll come in, and it's like a pound net in fisheries. They'll hit this thing and they'll go along here and they'll go into the traps. Now these are just some southern toads that we just put it out, experimented with. This is not the species we want, but we got quite a catch right here. But over the whole Air Force base, we have 40 sites. We have 162 of these fences set out. We have 940 traps set over the whole reservation. And here's some more information about our sampling design. The high disturbance sites, the bombing, this is a particular bombing range. This yellow line represents the 300 meter home range of the gopher frog. We know that from previous studies people have done. It's very important to know when you're doing these kinds of studies, environmental stress studies, to know what the home range of organisms are. Does anybody think they know why that would be true? Why is knowledge of home range important, or how much the average distance moved? The reason is because if you're looking at effects, stressor effects, and you got something with a large home range, it's like a bird, you know, maybe a bird of prey. If you see an effect in that organ, a stress response in that organism, you don't know where he picked up that stress, in other words. But if you got something in a limited home range like 300 meters and you see an effect, you know that that organism was affected within this particular treatment area. So again, we have the low disturbance areas and with our ponds and our 300 meter home range. So we did all our sampling within this boundary of the 300 meter home range, showing some of the same kinds of things. This is on a bombing range. This is a very large pond that's almost dry, but you see these little blue dots that represent, each double blue dot represents one of these drift fences. So all around this pond we have these drift fences. And this is another range. We have fences set. There's a pond here. There's a pond here. And this is a major bombing range here. They've got some small ponds. This is interesting right here. This is an old bomb crater. And they call it the Gator Crater, not because for people from the University of Florida study it, but because last time we went there to sample, there was a 4-foot gator living in that old bomb crater. Nobody volunteered to put the traps in there. Okay, so, and then moving on, we have our areas that we've set our traps on a low activity range. You can see there's a pond here with all our traps. And then two reference areas. You can see all the difference in the reference and in the affected habitat. There's a pond here. There's a pond here, and then there's another reference area. We have a pond here, and a pond here, and a pond here. Okay, and then we put out these fences here. It's getting pretty dry. The fences are sitting way out of the water, but got a little bit of water. Here's a marshy area with a trap set. This is an old bomb crater full of water with the vegetation. These things are just full, Jerry, of periphyton. The water's really clear, and I don't know if it's because of some of these bomb residues from these bombs are high in nitrogenous compounds, which probably stimulates algae production. But and there's a newly formed bomb crater, and I couldn't get any volunteers to go and set the traps down in there. I doubt frogs will go down in there. Yeah, that's a pretty amazing crater there. The reason I haven't showed you any results, because we're just sitting at the lab waiting at the rain enough so we can go down there and sample. But what we're going to do when we do sample, we're going to take each one of these frogs from each one of these sites and each one of these treatment areas, I got about 10 more minutes, I should be through. Is that we're going to, again, look at indicators at the biomolecular level, moving up levels of organization, the physiological, immunological, reproductive, and population area. And the reason we're going to do that is because stress responses at this lower level here, the lower levels of organization, their early warning signs are they're very sensitive to stress, like DNA damage, oxidative DNA stress, but they have low ecological relevance. Things we're measuring at the population level, we'll be measuring the relative abundance of frogs by two methods. One by just the abundance in the traps, because the number of traps we set and the fences we set at each pond, we tried to make it in proportional to the surface area. So we sort of get an estimate of populations that way. And another way we're going to get relative abundance, we have a herp specialist on contract working with us, and he's going to wade these ponds and count egg masses. So that's one way to get a good population estimate. And he can identify each frog has a specific type of egg mass. That's what they tell me. I'm a fish guy, so I don't know much about that kind of stuff. But he can go along and count the egg masses and say how many females bred in this pond. So we want to look at a whole suite then of responses, stress responses, along this gradient here. And the reason we want to do that is, is we take all of these responses at the lower levels and correlate them to predict the reproductive variables and to population variables. And the reason we're doing that is we want to provide the military an environmental assessment tool where they can go out and measure a selective suite of these things and say, yes, these populations are potentially at risk. But there's two problems with assessing the status of threatened and endangered species by population surveys, which most people do. Two major problems. Anybody want to guess what the issues are there? A threatened and endangered species, by definition, probably has low population abundance. So what does that mean if you want to go out and try to inventory that population? You can't find the suckers, can you? It's not enough. If you found some, see, you count a few, well, is that representative of the population? And the other problem is of doing the way the classical look at population estimates of threatened and endangered species is that by the time you see a change at the reproductive or population level, it's over with. You might as well warm the bus up and go home. Just like Lady Vols playing the Carson Newman, it's time to leave. You know. So we don't want our resources to get to that point. What we need is we need to provide environmental regulators, you know, these military most large military bases have their own environmental groups, people that go out and study these things, and they don't want to wait till the population crashes. They want some early warning signs, just like a doctor. Looks like now they get more early warning signs of cancer and stuff like that before it metastasizes or gets to the level it's past due. You know, I mean, it's gone. You're gone. So we want to help the military develop these. A suite of sensitive indicators that they can be used to tell them if their resource is at risk from military activities or stressors. Okay, just three or four slides to sort of summation, integration kind of stuff. I've said some of this in various ways before, but if we want to look at the effect of environmental stressors on organisms' stress response, we need to be looking at some highly sensitive responses that occur in a short-term frame. We also want to be looking at the same time ecological relevant kinds of things, but which go from sub-lethal, sub-cellular to the community. But the problem is Most programs say go out. I can't go out. I've had people say, we don't have enough money, manpower, resources to go out and measure everything. What do? Well, you sort of take it in between. The focus of field studies for looking at environmental stress would be sort of be at the organism level. You sort of focus on organism level responses, but at the same time look at a few quick response things like perhaps biochemical responses. At the same time, you need to look at some reproductive and population kinds of things. That same concept is reflected here. If you have environmental stressors, first affects it at the suborganism level. And these responses occur in a short time frame, usually minutes to days. These are sensitive early warning of exposure. This can be used in ecological risk assessment. If the stressors continue, we maybe see changes at the individual level, like at the population level, can be reflected as injury. And then if stress continues, then it affected at the population community level. But we don't want to wait till the populations and the communities are crashing or impaired before we see there's a problem. We want to be able to look at some of these things and raise a red flag and say, we got a problem with our resource. We need to do something about it. Same type of concept here. We look at these sensitive biomarkers, the genetic biochemical level. This gives us a high mechanistic understanding of what's happening at the organism level, but they have poor ecological relevance. But as we go up so the idea is we want to measure things along this gradient. Now, okay, so I think I have two slides left. So we sort of summarize then these multiple indicators of stress are. There's no space there. Early warning indicators of environmental problems. That's a major advantage. Everybody's heard about the canary in the mine thing. You know, the miners used to take canaries in their mines, deep mines, and if the bird started squawking or flapping its wings, that means it was shrunk. It was an early indicator there was a problem, so the miners could get out. These things also provide insights into the causal mechanisms linking stressors and biological effects. The next slide will improve on that, show you what I mean. And because most organisms are exposed to multiple stressors, we need to be able to separate out cumulative and synergistic effects. Helps us identify the source of damage. And if we can identify the source of damage or the stressors involved, we can better regulate the environment, help clean it up, remedial actions, those kinds of things. So the idea then, you saw this before, we have all these stressors. And so the way that we establish the link between these various stressors and effects in terms of causality is using a suite of carefully chosen multiple stress responses that are both sensitive to the environment, to the stress response, but also give you information about the ecological relevance of that response. And next to the last slide, the whole idea, again, medical profiling. You know, in people, and measure all these things, they get a medical diagnosis. So there are amphibians that are declining worldwide. We need to have a good environmental profile. These are just some of the things we might measure. Depends on the environment, we might not measure these. Some of them we would. So, I got one more slide, but it's not a science slide. It's sort of a science slide. I have a question, and everybody needs to respond to this question. Either smile or leave or raise your hand or lay on the floor and wiggle or something. Okay. How many people here feel that they don't get the respect they deserve, either from their families or colleagues or boyfriend, girlfriend, their professor or whatever? Just, you know, old Rodney Dangerfield, who's dead now, never got the respect? Let's see who don't. You don't get respect. All of you, you got respect. Everybody, you get all the respect you deserve, right? Well, I ask you then to consider the case of the poor opossum. He really doesn't get the respect he reserves. This is the winner of Not My Job Award, awarded by the Arizona Department of Transportation. But, you know, no respect at all. Just painting right over. So, you can see how old that slide is. Look at that Chevy there. Okay, guys. My mouth's dry. Questions, comments, criticisms. When was the Oak Ridge study done? The stream. Yeah, we started that in very first, 86. I finished my study lasted about 15 years because they kept giving us money. I'm not going to turn the money down. Some of those studies are still ongoing because they're required by the state. See, a facility that large has what they call a NPDES permit, National Pollutant Elimination Discharge. The states, under authority of the U.S. EPA, say that any discharger in the public waters has to meet certain criteria of water quality standards and also biological life. They must maintain, quotes, the indigenous diversity of the stream. So a lot of that was initiated just to make sure that this facility wasn't messing up the stream and it was improving. So it's actually, I probably got about 10 or 12 papers related to that study. And Dr. Gray has my email. If you wanted to email me about, I have a website. Some of these concepts are on. Anything related? I got on the estuarine study. I got a publication. So if you want to email me, say, hey, send me some publications or information on blah. I'll send it to you. There's another question.
I was just going to ask that now that we've seen an aerial photo of Y-12, are we going to be questioned by the FBI? You can show us a picture.
Oh, did the FBI release it? I mean, let me do it.
I don't know.
No. Yeah. Now, they got, if you got inside of a building, they'd probably frown on that, but no, I've used that. That's a good question. Because it's one of the, it's threatened, and the funding agency who did this said basically wanted us to look at threatened or endangered species. There are other amphibians that are threatened or endangered, but they're either too small to do what we want to because I have to get blood out of them and things like that. I've got a federal permit. I can sacrifice a certain number of these, you know, to get the organs out and things like that. And just finding them is enough of them. So, all those things, when you do a program like this, you have to consider, is there enough of them? Are there a large enough size where you can get the material you want to do? Or can you get permits to either collect them and or sacrifice them? Now, the gopher tortoise that we're doing on a military base in southern Mississippi, if I even looked at one of them things wrong, they'd take me behind the boat shed and give me a lethal injection, you know. You can't do anything with them. You can't even look at them wrong. Even though Bubba catches them and eats them, but scientists can't do it. Yes, ma'am.
How do you deal with the desiccation of the amphibians
when they're
under stress?
That's a good question, yeah. We checked. The traps are set out late in the evening, and you usually check the next morning. And they put wet cloth in there. But originally, all the traps were supposed to be in the water. In fact, the traps had styrofoam installed in them, so on metal poles. So if it rained and water came up, the traps would float up on the poles. But the problem is the panhandle of Florida is in the second worst drought there's ever been. The spring of 06 was the worst, the driest ever in the panhandle of Florida ever, right in the middle of my study. So my conclusion is probably after this study I'm out of the big time frog business. It's too risky. Tortoises, man, you know, they got a limit. They're right there. They're stay-at-home kind of guys. You can get them. Frogs are neat animals, but you got to get them. Yes, ma'am.
Do the contaminants stay in the food sources? Does that keep it up in the food chain longer than if it wasn't in the fermentation and frogs are going to eat? Does that just keep it up in there at a high level?
Most. You're talking about bioconcentration up the food chain? Is that what you're talking? Yeah, typically, most contaminants, particular PCBs, are associated with fats and lipids. You know, you go to a boat ramp anywhere in East Tennessee, it says do not eat catfish or striped bass above a certain size. That's because the PCBs are lipophilic. They tend to be associated with fat, and they're bioaccumulated up the food chain. Mercury is bioaccumulated up. Some metals are not. But yeah, typically, things are bioconcentrated at each different level of the food chain. So top predators, you know, like ospreys or, you know, kingfishers or something like that, or tuna fish, you know, and mercury, they're all top predators, and they tend to have higher levels in, you know, the lower parts of the food chain. Does that answer your question? You mean like rooted plants? Macrophytic plants and water, do they take it from the soil?
And bring it up to the top and just keep it coming up to the top.
There's a whole new area called bioremediation where, like, some contaminated sites, people have suggested, maybe you know more about this than I do, you're a wetlands guy, growing plants, because the plants will take it from the soil and they harvest the plants to throw away, something like that. But that's not true of all contaminants, is it? I mean, from the soil, some more than others.
Yeah, the more mobile ones, there have been some studies that have suggested that wetland plants will take up heavy metals. But they have to be in contact with it, that's the thing. I really can't provide much more detail on that either.
And that just keeps it continually into the food chain at approximately the same amount as originally.
Yeah, that's when you're getting down into plants, I leave that to jury expertise. Okay, guys, what you want to know about frogs? Yeah.
You're talking about the contaminants messing with DNA.
Mm-hmm.
What's an example? You mean like mutation
wise? Yeah, they can do a couple of things. One is good. Certain contaminants or genotoxic can actually cause strand breakages in DNA. I'm not a gene jockey kind of guy, but I know that certain contaminants can cause mutations. And the way they do that is that primarily that certain contaminants are acted on by certain detoxification enzymes that, in detoxifying that contaminant in the body, make it a more toxic to the gene itself, and they're called DNA adducts. It's something that attaches onto the gene and actually will cause mutations in certain loci. There's only certain contaminants that do that. PAHs, you know, the oil derivative, polyaromatic aromatic compounds, you know, oil derivatives are particularly notorious for causing mutations in genes. We haven't, no, we're waiting for it to rain. We ain't got a single frog yet. No. We're all packed in.
Though, huh?
What's that?
You've got some toads?
Like yeah, they just caught some toads. They just open the traps and see those traps have a funnel open in each end. We just stick drinking cups in each end, and when they think it's going to rain, they go and take the cups out. And they were just testing them, and they go, we might have to go to plan. One of our options is do toads. I mean, the southern toad is pretty abundant down there, and they don't need a lot of water necessarily to lay their eggs like the gopher frog does. They can just do it moist soil or something like that. But then we get into the problem of how do you get a population estimate? We can't count egg masses if, you know. We just need some rain. I mean, we need a lot of rain. Yep.
When you're talking about that experiment, you were saying that you were also going to use maybe a leopard frog, so the leopard frog as a backup.
Mm-hmm.
Would you, if you caught those in the trap at the same time, would you run the same tests on them anyway?
We would. Sure will. We're set up to probably do 300 or 400 frogs for this study, and we wouldn't anticipate getting a lot of gophers and leopards all at the same site, but they have somewhat similar life history characteristics. And good thing about leopard frogs, they're not in danger or threatening. We can just sacrifice all those we want to, because we're going to be doing histopathology on these. That means we're going to be taking the liver, spleen, kidney, and lung for selected individuals, I mean subsampling, and do pathology on them. Look on the scope and see if they're diseased, if the tissue's messed up, things like that. Some of these compounds that come out of exploded bombs, they're called explosive residuals, like TNT byproducts, are really pretty toxic.